It was subsequently destroyed by bandits. Faint click. The skeleton even made a rush towards the little crowd. But I had quietly put my arms behind my back in a natural manner. The Lama walked on shaking his head, and the Tibetan crowd immediately began to talk about strange noises produced by ghosts. One half an hour later, the crowds began to move towards the central courtyard of the monastery where the Sungmai, one of the famous oracles of the Tibetans, was to invite the demons to descend into his body in the presence of a large crowd. Although I made it a practice to avoid moving with crowds whenever I could, I realized the impossibility of isolating myself, as it was to be expected that every corner of the courtyard and the galleries would be crowded to cracking point by the several thousand pilgrims who had come to the monastery for the event, added to the many hundred lamas living there. I had gone to the courtyard immediately after puzzling the skeleton lama with the click of the miniature camera, and managed to get a fairly good place right in front whence I could watch proceedings very closely. For a whole hour after this, crowds continued to pour into the courtyard and the many galleries from all sides. As the time approached for the event, the merry laughs and chatter of the multitude gradually gave way to breathless suspense. Finally the Sungmai arrived, accompanied by a large crowd of lamas of high rank, and made his entrance in a ceremonious fashion. He was middle-aged, strong and well-built, and wore bright clothes of excellent quality. He looked exceedingly prosperous. It is a fact that the Sungmai business is probably the one which pays best in Tibet. Naobu, the wealthy Tibetan with whom I made friends later on, told me that the income of the famous Sungmis of Tibet equals the income of several thousand nomad families. The fee paid to a Sungmai for one such public sitting may equal the annual income of 50 nomad families. The oracle slowly and ceremoniously advanced towards his seat and sat down in occidental fashion, but the crowd of lamas remained standing throughout the ceremony apart from a few old lamas of high rank who sat down in the Tibetan manner on their jaya bols. Footnote. Bells began to ring, and a procession of priests walked round the prosperous oracle with incense burners, which in most cases are made of the upper portion of human skulls. The suspense of the crowd was intense and everybody was watching the Sungmai, who slowly lapsed into a state of trance. His face grew pale, his fingers crisped, and from time to time he was shaken by convulsions from head to foot. The great moment had arrived. Either demons began to descend into his body. The lamas blew trumpets to herald their arrival. From minute to minute the convulsions of the oracle increased in number and amplitude. Finally, his whole body swayed forward and backward as if it were pushed about by invisible entities of extraordinary strength. The crowd grew too excited to remain quiet. Footnote. Cushions, the number of which varies according to the rank of the lama. Their breathless suspense gave way to occasional shouts of amazement and a strange kind of religious frenzy. "Lashan," said an old Tibetan, who stood near me. I failed to understand him. "La" means god or demon, and "shan" means to ride. The demon rides. What could he have meant by it? While the convulsions of the Sungmai increased in violence and the crowd gave vent to their emotions by shouting and gesticulating, I wondered what the demon rides meant, and then suddenly I understood. The demon had descended into the body of the oracle to ride his body, just as does a rider who takes possession of a horse. I now the Sungmai had reached such a state of frenzy that a Western physician would have felt some anxiety for him. One might have been afraid that he would bite his tongue off. Footnote. Or fall down as the victim of a stroke. His face was dark red and swollen as if someone had wound a string round his neck to stifle him. Blood came out of his mouth, ears, and nose, and he began to groan like a wild animal. Trumpets sounded once more, and a lama exhorted the crowd to remain silent. The culminating part of the ceremony had begun. The demon had entirely taken possession of the body of the Sungmai, and the moment had come to. Footnote. In speaking Tibetan, the tongue is very often put in between the teeth, so that many Tibetans are in the habit of continually putting their tongue in between their teeth. As a matter of fact, about 6 of the 28 Tibetan consonants are pronounced with the tongue put in between the teeth. Put questions to him. Several lamas approached with loose pieces of paper on which the various questions were written. The oracle took them one by one, rubbing the slips against the crown of his head. He answered each question in a low voice, audible only to the lamas surrounding him. The answer to at least one of the questions was so copiously mixed with groans that it could hardly have made any sense. The answers, however, were carefully recorded by the lamas in all instances. I wonder in what way they recorded the groans and what interpretation they gave to them. The Tibetan Sanghmas are much more respected than the simple Powas footnote, who are equally able to go into a state of trance and answer questions whilst obsessed by demons. In the opinion of the wise men of Tibet, the giving up of one's body for any purpose whatsoever to invisible entities so that they can temporarily take possession of it is one of the greatest crimes which a human being can commit against his soul. The divine spark in man, his soul, is greatly offended and brutalized by them. If the soul leaves such a being, such a man remains soulless for all eternity and enters the downward current of life, which leads him down again in the opposite direction, through the whole process of evolution to nothingness and total annihilation. Allel, the horrible types of animals and plants, if they say, are incarnations of such falling entities. The Sanghmas of Tibet must lead unnatural lives in order to retain the faculty to be obsessed by their footnote. Mediums, if such as snakes, toads, parasites, etc. gods or demons. They are not allowed to have sexual intercourse. They voluntarily abstain from many amenities of life so as to be able to go on with their business. They must live on a special diet. As to the food they take, I heard different stories, but it seems that eggs and various kinds of meat are strictly forbidden. When only the material aspect of things is taken into consideration, the Tibetan Sanghmas may be compared with certain patients in Western lunatic asylums whose disease is scientifically called dual personality. The occultist and the materialistic nerve specialist cannot possibly agree on these matters, for they both approach the problem from opposite directions. Nerve specialists know for a fact that in practically all cases of mental disease corresponding physical defects can be found, and for the nerve specialist the mental trouble is a consequence of the physical one. The occultist takes the opposite view. For him the mental trouble, obsession, etc., is the cause and the physical trouble the result of it. Both the nerve specialist and the occultist are right from their angle, and it is not to be expected that they will agree on the fundamental cause of mental complaints. After the Sanghmas had answered a series of questions, the spectacular part of the show began. This was obviously intended for the large crowds, especially for the majority of the people who had no possibility to get near enough to see the face of the oracle. A big sword was brought in by two lamas, who appeared to be stooping under its weight. I could not help noting smilingly that the lamas chosen for transporting the sword were about the frailest and shortest specimens of the whole lot. Obviously the effect of two lamas carrying a sword was calculated to impress the multitude, especially the Tibetans standing far away who were unable to see that the two lamas were very frail. The sword was ceremoniously handed to the Sanghmas, who stood up and in a state of frenzy touched the ground with its point. He then folded the sword with his bare hands as if it had been made of hot wax. Immediately afterwards the folded sword was carried towards the crowd, who made a mad scramble for it. The people could ascertain that the sword weighed perhaps 25 pounds, and that the steel was so substantial that even the strongest man could not have bent it with his bare hands. A substitution of the sword folded by the Sanghmas by another sword was quite impossible, as the whole thing was done publicly in the presence of several thousand people. By the way, such cases of dual personality in which men show an unaccountable degree of physical strength have also been studied in lunatic asylums and by occultists in Western countries. The folding of the heavy sword seemed to put the Tibetan multitude into a state of frenzy. Crowds easily fuse into one group soul, and then the individual no longer behaves as he would behave individually. Crowds really are not the sum total of all the individualities present. They seem to be a suddenly formed new entity actuated by a kind of group soul. It is man sinking back temporarily into the group consciousness from which civilized man is just about to emerge. I think only the greatest of the great, such as Shakespeare or Goethe, were fully and definitely individualized and beyond the possibility of lapsing back temporarily into group consciousness. Mild Tibetans, who would never dream of doing such a thing individually, made a mad rush forward to get near the Sangmai, who still swayed to and fro and had just begun to spit out violently in various directions. What an honor for the average Tibetan to be spat at by a Sangmai while a god or demon was riding the latter. I think he would not forget this supreme distinction while he lived. I, the maddened crowd, pushed me forward towards the Sangmai. Women and children screamed, and serious accidents seemed to be inevitable. But the Tibetan lamas are a well-organized body. The police force of the monastery put in an appearance almost immediately in the shape of about 60 lamas of the taller and stronger variety, carrying sticks and whips. A minute later the crowd was pushed back in a very energetic and ruthless manner. The whipping lamas did their best to show off the power of the police force. Not even women and children were spared by them. I happened to be in one of the foremost rows and tried to bow a little as much as I could do so in the crowd to protect myself from the birch whips of the police lamas, at the same time trying hard to protect as much as possible a beautiful young Tibetan girl standing next to me. When the front row had been pushed back about 20 yards from the Sangmai, the police force retired, apparently proud and satisfied with the rapid and efficient manner in which order had been restored. The girl had received a stroke of the whip on her hands, which she had held before her face to protect it, and although I made it a practice not to speak inside the Tibetan monasteries and posed as a deaf and dumb native, I departed from the practice on this special occasion, and asked her, Kyodpa Santermo Rag? Footnote. She smiled, and we began to converse. Her name was Dolma. She had come a long way from her village situated near Taratshan. She and her mother had joined a large group of Neskorpas / and would travel back the long distance to their native village the day after tomorrow. During the row she had been separated from her mother and her friends, but would join them soon after the ceremony. She was a very beautiful girl, and after 10 minutes' conversation I found that she was remarkably clever too. Unfortunately, not all women who are beautiful are also clever. Nature often seems to hesitate to bestow too many gifts on the same individual. She asked me my name and where I came from. My name is Chedi, I said, and I have come here to stay 2 days to see the Sangmai and the show to be played tomorrow. How many are you? She asked. I travel all alone, I answered. She gave a merry laugh, showing her beautiful teeth perhaps a little more than was really necessary. Footnote. Do you fessy pain? F. Pilgrims. Do such a thing as travel quite alone. By the way, I never met a ladki. Do all ladkis talk Tibetan in such a funny manner? A loud blast of many dozen trumpets interrupted our conversation. The Sangmai had ceased to move about and looked as lifeless as a corpse. His face had become like yellowish wax and was dreadful to look at. Would you like to meet my mother and my friends? Asked Dolma. No, I said. She looked very disappointed. Why? I want Tenpa, I said. Even when I am near you? No. Yo, you are an exception. She looked very pleased. I had a good look at her dress. Everything about her was remarkably clean, which is almost a phenomenon in Tibet. Trumpets were blown again. After a slight pause there came a rapid succession of many blasts, a signal that the gods or demons had definitely departed. The Sangmai was surrounded by a large crowd of helpers. So many people brought him drink, or washed and massaged him, that it was no longer possible to see his face. Only several dozen lamas and his special suite had access to him. The crowd was still kept at a certain distance and slowly began to disperse. Footnote. People from Ladakh. F. Solitude. Are you going back to your friends now? I asked Dolma. This is not urgent, Chedi, she answered, carefully arranging her beautiful hair. If I join them in an hour I shall be in time for our meal. Where will you stay? I shall leave the monastery, I answered, go out into the surrounding neighborhood, and return tomorrow for the show. But where is your Chedi? I laughed. It is wound round my body, and so is my blanket. So you carry your house wound round your body? She remarked, laughing loudly. Yes, but some of my belongings are also hidden in the neighborhood, I said. What a mysterious person you are, One Inch, she exclaimed. Gradually our conversation drifted to more vital matters. For half an hour we conversed about Myla Raspa, called Short Mila by the Tibetans, and Padmasambhava, who wrote legends which are very different from the mild and cheerful legends of Mila and contain descriptions of horrible scenes of cannibalism and unimaginable depravities. More and more I was amazed how much that little girl knew and how enormously she was above the educational standard of other Tibetans. Are there many Bumo MD, Karites Ma / in your village who know as much as you do? I asked. Perhaps not, she said. Where did you learn all this? Nice, tent. Tea Tibetan girls. That is a secret, answered Dolma. I have had my teachers. Does your mother like your teachers? She would not like them, perhaps, she said, but she has never met them. Why? She would not understand them, so I never take them home. Dolma promised me to get away from her friends the following morning. We would then walk about for an hour or so and go together to the show in the monastery. Goodbye, said Dolma. Goodbye, Chedi from Ladawak. Her laugh rang out merrily. I wondered whether there had been a mocking expression in her face when she added from Ladakh. When we met again the following day, Dolma immediately talked about the dangers I had faced while spending the night alone in my tent at a place about 10 miles from the monastery. There are many bandits in the neighborhood, she said. Early this morning two solitary travelers passed our party of Neskorpus footnote. They were in a pitiful plight, having been robbed of nearly all their belongings. When they were gone my mother and the other pilgrims had a good laugh about them. In many other countries people pity those who are robbed or at least they pretend to do so. I am why mother laughs at such people, she said. And so do others. Footnote. But you mentioned other countries. I was in Jayadkaf once. How did you get there? I know a very powerful man, she answered. He is very rich, perhaps one of the richest persons in the country. He lives in a splendid song. He is very educated and even speaks languages other than Tibetan. I accompanied him to India 2 years ago. Are you going to marry him, Dolma? No. My mother is very anxious that I should meet him as often as possible, but she does not understand. Naabu is a great spiritual power and I am one of his pupils. We walked on for a few minutes without saying anything. Naabu is a little like you, Chedi, she went on. He is the type of man who would sleep alone in a tent in a district infested by bandits. He is not afraid of wild animals either. Are you never attacked by animals? Seldom, I answered. The animals which are on the rising branch of life are very kind to me. I do not think even a lion would attack me, although I never met one. I have had very pleasant experiences, though, with bears and some other so-called wild animals. I heard a story about a bear, said Dolma. I will tell it to you. Perhaps you will be able to tell. Footnote. It is a shame in Tibet to be a victim of robbers, because the fact of having been robbed denotes a lack of cunning. If India percent large and expensive house. Me whether such a thing can happen. A man who often broke the law which prohibits hunting had obtained a white man's death stick. Footnote. In the Lhasa district, and when he returned to his province he went out bear hunting. He had shot several bears, but one day, just while he followed the track of an animal, a strong bear suddenly appeared just behind his back. I can quite believe this, I observed, for bears are perhaps the most silent creatures when they move about, and they certainly can take a hunter unawares. Wait a moment. The hunter was so afraid when he saw the big bear just behind his back that he dropped his gun and stared aghast at the animal, who could have crushed him in a couple of seconds. And what happened? I asked. Well, said Dolma. And now comes the part of the story I had some difficulty in believing. The bear looked at the frail creature who stood tremblingly before him, his gun lying at his feet, and calmly walked away. I can believe that, I said, for bears have a soul, although they are only at times individualized. By the way, it is easy to say whether the hunter in the story had a soul or not. If the hunter had a soul, it was impossible for him to take up the gun to shoot after the bear. If he was soulless, he would have done so at once. Are there soulless animals too? Footnote. Gun, T. How? Oh yes. The animals on the descending branch of life are soulless. Which ones, for example? There are many. Ravens, rats, mice, vermin, for instance. They behave like a soulless man? Yes. Did these entities inhabit men before? Perhaps, many thousand years ago. When they lost their soul, they began to move downward. It is very strange. When I visited India, I heard so much about progressive evolution that life always passed upward, that the souls in minerals became souls in plants, then in animals, and after this in man, and that man finally must become an angel, and that all this is only a question of time. Life would have no meaning if there was no alternative between light and darkness, Dalma, I said. There are two currents of life. One is moving upward and the other downward. The moment one loses one's soul, one is precipitated into the downward current. How can one lose one's soul? By sinning against one's soul, Dalma. By a sensual life? Oh, no, in most cases that is a sin against one's body. Yo, you may suffer for it in this life or in some future incarnation. By treating others badly, then? No, as a rule, even this is no sin against your soul. You will get your punishment for treating others badly in this or some future incarnation, although wanton cruelty to defenseless creatures, rat-like ingratitude, or an innate tendency to spy on others already reveal a certain degree of soullessness which may be due to sins committed against one's soul in former incarnations. Well, then, what is a sin against one's soul? Using spiritual things for selfish purposes. Dragging God down on earth. Trying to put one's self on a level with the Creator. Dalma was awe-stricken. Then many of us hear sin like that, she exclaimed. Yes, Dalma, but also people in other countries. In India. Certainly. In P/INPA? Footnote. She looked at me in a very queer way when she said that. Oh, of course, there some people sin against their soul too. P/INPA must resemble Tibet in certain respects, I added after a while. I will tell you something interesting, said Dalma. Narabu, my teacher, has told me that P/INPA is not at all one country. It is a country divided into many small provinces which often take a stand one against another. Really? In some ways you are very similar to Narabu, Shetty, but in others, especially in spiritual matters, you do not say exactly the same things. I think he would very much like to meet you to discuss such matters. Footnote. The country of the white people. Telin really means a being from a distant island. Island is translated Lingorimgbring in Tibetan. Where is he at present? I asked. He travels very much. He may be at home at present. A few weeks ago he returned to his Dzong from Lhasa. He will go soon to the Valley of Mystery. The Valley of Mystery? If you do not know what the Valley of Mystery is, I am not allowed to tell you more about it. So please do not mention it anymore, she said, with a firmness which was almost startling in so young a girl. She noticed my disappointment, smiled, and said sweetly, but I will give you an introduction to Naobu. But please promise me one thing. What is it? When you meet Narabu, do not tell him that I mentioned to you the Valley of Mystery. I thought you knew all about it when I said that word, because you seem to know so much about spiritual matters. I am bound by a solemn oath not to speak of the valley. If Narabu wants to tell you something about it, he may do so, as he occupies a much higher rank in the occult fraternity. More and more I was dumbfounded. There is no such thing as coincidence in this world. We make chance acquaintances, but everything in our lives seems to be guided by an intricate mechanism, the working of which we failed to see. We had arrived at the central court of the monastery where the theatrical performance was to take place. It was to last many hours and the public came along, carrying a fairly large quantity of food and drink. We went on chatting and the time passed very rapidly. The Tibetans are people who take their time. 3/4 of an hour before the time fixed for the show, the courtyard and the galleries were already packed with people, although the crowds were perhaps a little smaller than the previous day, when the Sangmai had appeared to make a demonstration of his capacity to enter publicly in contact with his gods or demons. I glanced at Dolma again and again. Was it possible that this little girl was the friend and spiritual disciple of a rich and powerful Tibetan who occupied a prominent position in the country, and was a member of a powerful secret body? Of course, there was something about Dolma which distinguished her enormously from any other Tibetan girl of her age. I looked at her dress. It was very simple and yet almost elegant. She did not make the smallest display of ornaments, which is a very uncommon thing amongst Tibetan women. She was clean, which is another remarkable feature in Tibet. She was educated and knew a lot, not only about Tibet but also about India. I once more looked at her fully, comparing her with the crowd around us. It was like looking at a duchess who had borrowed the clothes of one of her servants and was mixing with a crowd in the East End. The merry chatter of the people died away. The performance had begun. It was very difficult for me to understand all that was said by the actors. First of all, the classical language used differed to some extent from colloquial Tibetan, the difference being about as great as the one between modern English used in business correspondence and the English in the Shakespeare folio. Furthermore, many of the actors wore masks, which rendered understanding still more difficult. On the other hand, however, the plot of the play was very slight. Developments which would take perhaps 3 minutes on an English stage were drawn out into scenes lasting sometimes 40 minutes. Moreover, the dialogue was supported by enormous gestures enabling even people seated at a considerable distance to guess developments. Taking all in all, I could understand a great deal. The play glorified renunciation and non-resistance to evil. Again and again it stressed the prospect of getting happiness as a reward for renunciation. The hero of the play, I use the word in a technical sense, for a pitiful hero he was for that matter, was out to discard his personality in order to get happiness. Why do people seek an unselfish conception of life? Is it because we have so much love and sympathy with the troubles of others that we begin to be ashamed of our selfishness which causes so much suffering? Or is it because we want happiness in exchange for a non-egocentrical conception of life? In the play performed in the monastery, the motive of the hero was the latter and not the former. He wanted bliss as a reward for discarding his personality. The play started with an exceedingly long monologue on the evils of existence. I quote from memory. The taking down of notes while I traveled in disguise in Tibet was most difficult and only possible on rare occasions. The hero in the play dwelt at great length on the various evils of existence. He seemed to lose sight of the many things which make life worth living and which are partly even within the reach of people not specially favored by fortune, such as love, friendship, enthusiasm, beauty of nature, etc. Life is bad, he mused. Life is suffering and pain only. Nothing is real. Everything is unreal. Annihilation is the goal. I looked at beautiful Dolma. I looked at the sun generously filling with his radiant light the courtyard of the monastery, and wondered whether the poor hero realized what dreadful blasphemy he was uttering. What? The Creator should have made this wonderful universe full of suffering, true, but also full of enjoyment, the suffering preventing enjoyment from becoming monotonous for the purpose that his creatures should realize that existence was an evil and that their supreme goal was to escape from it. I compared the poor hero in the Tibetan play with the glorious figure of Hamlet, who intensely feels the dreadful tragedy of being only a man and nothing but man. Being a genius and capable of the most intense feelings, Hamlet suffers infinitely more than the Tibetan hero, but nevertheless he has the courage and nobility of character to face his troubles as a creature without any thought of escape or salvation. The hero was married and had children. He worked to feed his family. He was attacked by a swarm of mosquitoes. The lamas had a strange stage trick to represent an enormous swarm of mosquitoes. I wondered how it was done, but it looked very genuine. The hero gave his lifeblood to the mosquitoes. The dear little ones, he said, Let them have a good meal.